The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Chris Bateman is a game designer, outsider philosopher, and author. His book, Imaginary Games, was published by Zero Books in 2011. Bateman is also a blogger, and he posts regularly on the website Only a Game, in between writing how-to manuals on game design and lecturing at the University of Bolton. John Cogburn, director of philosophy at LSU, blurbed Imaginary Games this way. Chris Bateman's Imaginary Games may just do for video games what Noel Carroll's The Philosophy of Horror did for scary books and movies. Not only philosophically compelling and interesting, it is also a great read. It's Wednesday, July 22nd, 2015, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. In this episode, you'll hear a rerun of a conversation about the movie Tron between me and my then 13-year-old son, Ben, theme music from Super Smash Bros. Melee, Chad African explaining Zizek and his idea of ontological incompleteness, clips from a YouTube documentary about Smash, and a short clip on Hegel from the 8-Bit Philosophy series. The music you're listening to now is from Super Mario Bros., of course, but in just a moment, you'll hear Chris Bateman and I discuss imaginary games. Dr. Chris Mark Bateman is a game designer, outsider philosopher, and author best known for the games Discworld Noir and Ghostmaster. The books Game Writing, Narrative Skills for Video Games, 21st Century Game Design, and Beyond Game Design, 9 Steps Towards Creating Better Video Games, and his eclectic philosophy blog, Only a Game. In 2011, Zero Books published Bateman's first book of philosophy entitled Imaginary Games, and that's what we'll be discussing today. Chris Bateman, welcome to Zero Squared.
Thanks, Doug. It's great to be here.
So you've published 3 books with us. One of them just became what I consider to be a Zero Books bestseller, which means that it passed the 500 mark. I'm paying attention to it again. We were kind of discussing the ins and outs of book publishing. I feel like you're actually a great person to talk to about book publishing because you have a strategic mind. Would that be fair to say that
who knows whether I'm a good person to talk to about anything, but I do dig into things in a very strategic fashion. And book publishing has been strange for me because I've had quite a few experiences with a lot of companies of very different sizes. I've published with smaller boutique publishers, but also some of the books you mentioned there from my bio were originally published by a small publisher that got bought by a bigger publisher that got bought by a bigger publisher. So I now have books with Cengage, who is one of the world's largest publishers as well. So I get this really schizophrenic view of the world of publishing, and it's a strange, strange world. And
your book, which one is your bestseller, do you think?
It's without a doubt, it's Game Writing, Narrative Skills for Video Games, which is a how-to book about writing storytelling in games. And I'm the editor of this. I wrote 2 of the chapters, but a bunch of different people wrote the individual chapters. It was a pain of a project to put together, but it was worthwhile. And it was one of the first books to come out to really dig into how to do storytelling in games.
Okay, and who buys that book? Is this going to people who are like amateur video game programmers at home, or is this mostly a professional book, or who do you think grabs
it. Certainly gets picked up by enthusiastic amateurs. I think a lot of the sales, it's used as a course book on a lot of university courses that teach video games. So I'm pretty sure the reason it has been such a good seller for me is that it's been taken as a course book. And I think it's good in that role because it takes the perspective of a lot of people who've worked in writing for games and shares what they can tell you about that experience in a very accessible way. I think it's a really good example of that form. It's not the kind of book I'd want to spend the rest of my life writing, but I'm glad to have worked on that project, and it's done very well for me.
That's great. Now, you've written three books for Zero, and imagine if you – here are the titles. The Mythology of Evolution, Chaos Ethics, and Imaginary Games. And I think I started in the middle, but I'm not sure which one. I know Imaginary Games was your first.
Yeah, chronologically, Imaginary Games, Mythology of Evolution, Chaos Ethics.
Yeah.
But although this is a trilogy in that they all deal with my philosophy of imagination, you could read any one of those books, and you could read them in any order, or you could just read one of them and call it quits, which is probably what most people do.
So as your publisher, your publicist, and as someone who's interested, and most especially in sales, what kind of course would teach these books?
Ah, well, an insane course would teach these books, frankly. I do use imaginary games in some of my teaching about games and game narrative. I think it's a really interesting way of looking at the relationship between games and art. I believe there is a course in the US that uses Mythology of Evolution, but I don't know much about it. I haven't been able to investigate that. And Chaos Ethics only really just came out, so this one's still finding its feet. Although a lot of colleagues who read and enjoyed it said they enthusiastically grabbed a copy to stick into their university library. I suspect that has more to do with the way that book challenges the idea that these tight organizational structures can ever be moral. I suspect it's them having a kick back at their local bureaucracy by sticking it in the library more than anything else. But hey, if it works, I'm going to support it.
So let me ask you a question that's real general here. What is fictionalism?
Fictionalism is a school in philosophy that questions the idea that what we call fiction or fictional is a signpost for trivial. So the fictionalist philosophies, and there's a bunch of them, and they all have very different focus, are all interested in looking closely at fiction and saying, we have a lot to learn about everything, really, by really kicking the tires of what we mean by fiction. So the easiest way of getting across fictionalism is ordinarily we would say either it's real or it's fiction. And most of the fictionalist schools come in and say, well, actually, whatever it is you're saying is real, some fiction is involved in getting there. And so you can never really tease apart the real and the fictional quite as easily as we've come to assume.
What kinds of questions, philosophical questions, does fictionalism address itself to? Like, for instance, does fictionalism help a philosopher settle problems about, say, epistemology, about the problem of perception, how we know what we know? Does it settle problems of ontology? Does it say that the world itself is somehow partly fictional? Does it take a Kantian perspective and say what we know is partly fictional, but there's a world of reality that's out there?
Every single example you put there, you could probably find a fictionalist who would slot comfortably into that space. So the main issue when you're coming at things from a fictionalist perspective is to ask what the relationship, well, in the way I put it in my books, what the relationship is between what we're expected to imagine and a particular situation. So, for instance, nobody really most people don't doubt that nations are real entities. They have real effects around us. Nation as an object isn't something detectable. We can't build a Star Trek tricorder that's going to measure a nation. In fact, the nation is something that we imagine, but we imagine that nation in a way that collectively creates that nation. And fictionalism is interested in these kind of relationships between what's imagined and what's experienced as real.
I just spent about 2 years very slowly reading The Phenomenology of Spirit.
Mm. That is a tough book to read.
When I hear this, I think of it in a Hegelian way. You're talking about the kinds of concepts which are collectively produced, like the nation, which are still real, but they're subjective. That's a subjective reality in some sense, even though it's collectively shared.
Yeah, so I mean, you've jumped straight in with this term subjective, and we use subjective and objective rather freely these days, and this is all kind of Kant's fault. And I'm a big Kant fan, so I don't want to knock Kant, but we've really taken on board this idea of dividing into subjective and objective. But actually making that cut in reality and separating off something that's objective from something that's subjective turns out to be incredibly difficult, if not impossible. And a lot of the strands in fictionalism really question some of the assumptions that we can easily split the world into these two boxes of objective and subjective. And the interrelations between our experiences as beings and what you might call the real outside it, very difficult to cleave easily into a subjective and an objective box.
Hey, it's the big master control program everybody's been talking about.
Kevin Flynn, computer genius. Taken prisoner and held captive within the digital world of the computer itself. Trapped inside an electronic arena where love and escape do not compute.
Hi, Ben.
Hi.
I wanted to show you a clip from the movie Tron and talk to you about Immanuel Kant and Bishop George Berkeley.
Okay.
Now, these were two idealist philosophers, and they were wrestling with the problem of perception. Do you know what the problem of perception is?
Basically, you can't really know if what you're seeing is real.
Right. You are always dealing with perception.
Mm-hmm.
And
you're always seeing things through a filter.
Your own mind. They presuppose that there's a real world out beyond the realm of our senses. And the question is, how do we gain access to it? How do we know those things? So you're right. That is the problem of perception. In Tron is actually a good metaphor for this problem of perception, even though it may not seem like one on the surface. Because in the movie Tron, you have these programs that are dealing with, you know, their perceptions. They're playing video games, you know, they're riding around on light cycles, or they're throwing discs at each other. And they take these things to be real. But they are also, there's a religion amongst the programs that there's a real world out beyond the program of users that have created the program. These two philosophers would be two different kinds of programs in Trump. George Berkeley would be, maybe he would be on the side of the master control program.
Right. That's the bad guy.
Yeah, that's the bad guy. The master control program wants to take over all programs.
Yeah.
And basically dictate to all programs how things should run. And he is trying to eliminate the very idea that there are users, that there is a world outside of the program.
But he talks to the users, doesn't he? I remember the one scene where there's a big computer and he's talking out of the table or something.
Yeah, that would be one way in which the master control program would be different than George Barkley. Because the master control program, to be just like George Barkley, would have to actually believe that there were no users, that there was no world outside of the program. And the other kind of philosopher is this guy, Immanuel Kant, and he's a program that does believe in the users, but he just believes that they're completely unknowable, that you can never gain access to the realm of the user. It's limited. There's a barrier between any program and the outside world.
Okay.
But what's interesting about Tron is that a user becomes a program.
Yeah.
In the movie Tron, that problem perception is solved with technology.
Right.
The real world is manifest in a program.
Mm-hmm. The real world, something from the real world, becomes part of the fake world.
Right. And so the question for philosophers is, how is that possible?
You use some kind of digitalizer ray?
Yeah, some sort of, laser gun, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay, well, how do video games help us understand fictionalism?
Do they? That's an interesting question.
Yeah, and do they? Because that's what I think. Isn't that what your first book is, Imaginary Games, is kind of about? Is partly describing fictionalism by using video games, and partly helping us understand video games better because we can understand fictionalism?
Yeah, I mean, definitely the two go together. I mean, on the one hand, I am using fictionalism to attempt to illuminate the experience of playing games, which at its heart is always imagining something. And this element of what we imagine when we're playing video games has been downplayed by the academic community. And one of the things I wanted to do in Imaginary Games was show how misleading it is to treat video games in ignorance of what they're expecting us to imagine. But on the other hand, it's this opportunity to illuminate fictionalism in our as a way of looking on the world by looking at something more familiar and perhaps innocent in some sense as a video game. So looking at the way video games make us imagine certain things shows us how we make similar assumptions about the world around us.
Give me an example of the kind of assumption we make in a video about a video game, or when we play a video game, that correlates to the kind of assumption that we make in our day-to-day lives that maybe is an error.
I'm wary to jump to saying something's an error. Usually what I'm interested in doing is pulling out intuitions in a particular area so that we can think more clearly about something. I'm not necessarily jumping to saying that something is wrong just because there's another way of looking at it.
That makes sense. But I always like saying things are wrong because it makes me then, I get people then, say, oh, you're wrong. Then they argue very strongly for their position. Maybe I
understand
it better.
Well, this is the publicist game, isn't it? The publicist has to create contention because otherwise people don't get involved. I've learned this on my blogs. If I don't make an absolutely strident statement, who is going to come and talk to me about it? So yeah, you've got to come in all guns firing. But so we tend to think of a game as something trivial, as a pastime, something that we do just to while away the hours. And video games disrupt this Because players of some video games pursue those video games with greater passion than they actually pursue their lives in some cases, and deleterious passions for some people who get, say, sucked into the world of Warcraft and drop out of university because they never make it out of the fantasy world that they're playing in.
Right.
And this capacity to be totally absorbed in this imaginary world that you've entered into is something that we associate with video games, but we do it just as much in our daily lives, in all sorts of situations. When we join a company and we imagine we're now part of that company, that has severe effects for how we then begin relating to the people around us. When we get married and we imagine that we've formed this bond with this other person, and it's a life-changing event, but it's also, if the two people have imagined completely different things about that marriage, it's a disaster waiting to happen as two different fictional worlds collide horrifically with each other, destroying lives in some cases.
So what do you think the difference is between the kind of imaginary world that you enter into when you play, say, World of Warcraft, and the kind of imaginary world that you enter into when you play a game like Pong? No, how about better yet, like Super Smash Brothers? I really want to talk to you. I don't know if we'll use it, but I want to talk to you about Super Smash Brothers because this game has entered my life through the...
And it is a game that enters people's life. It's that... This is the interesting thing about video games at the moment, and board games had this before them. From the 50s to 60s, games went through this transition whereby they began to take on more... more characteristics of long-term practices like sports and crafts. So you start getting games that require a level of commitment from you if you're going to play them. And Super Smash Brothers actually is a really good example of this, because you could just dabble in it. But if it gets its claws into you, you're going to start playing it in a very different way. It's going to pull you into its world completely. And in that respect, World of Warcraft and Super Smash Brothers, although the content of the gameplay is very different, both have this quality of establishing a grip on you and pulling you in a way that's going to keep you there. And what troubles me slightly about the way game design's gone in recent years is awareness of how games can do that has led to market forces ramping up that aspect of the design for the sole purpose of extracting money from players. And not every developer is guilty of this, but there's a nasty tendency now for games to be more focused on getting money out than in satisfying their players.
There seems to me like the Super Smash Brothers game, which, by the way, it's not something I'm addicted to or super involved in, but something I'm constantly being dragged off to play by my oldest son, who is considering himself to be, he's 18, he considers himself to be kind of training, but not that he ever has been to a tournament or anything, but just, like, I've watched the first 4 episodes of a 4-hour documentary about Super Smash that's on YouTube. That covers, you know, the old school days of 2003. Boy, what a way to feel old is to watch this thing. And it's fascinating, though. These people, back in, I guess, 2003, when Super Smash Melee, which was the second game, I believe.
That really did step up the interest in that as a franchise. It had a fan base before then, but that one in particular really pulled in fighting game players from other games and players who had never considered fighting games before.
Right. It became a game that, because it had certain kind of engine in it or a certain versatility, people would spend hours figuring out how to play very well. And you can do things in it. It's a very open space, it turns out, or there's a lot of different combinations and things that you can do, lots of different strategies, new ways of playing are opening up all the time. It's a kind of thing where the complexity in the game is one of its main appeals, and yet it's so fluid and so simple, you don't expect to find that complexity right. in the game.
It's a bit like, this is a bit like sport, and in fact I'm very interested in the places that video games become sport-like in the way that their player practices develop, because most sports you can see immediately from looking at that sport how it is supposed to be played, but then actually doing it, or even better, doing it well, requires a tremendous commitment on the part of the players of the sport and of some of these games with these levels of complexity behind them to mastering the practices that they support. And designing games that are going to support those levels of player practices is requires an awful lot of skill. It requires an awful lot of skill on the part of the developers. And I am very proud of the industry. I mean, even if I sometimes question the relationship that the industry has with its commercial side.
So how does a game like that, that's a sport, almost like Super Smash Brothers,
sport-like.
I mean, it is. I mean, there are tournaments, yeah. and people are winning thousands of dollars, and they're dedicating their lives to it. And this guy Ken, is, you know, I can tell you names of the biggest Super Smash Brothers because I watched this documentary. He's like he was the best Super Smash Brothers player in the world for 3-4 years. No one could beat him. Yeah. It's like the Muhammad Ali of Super Smash Brothers, you know.
Yeah.
So how does that fit with a fictionalist account of video games? How is there a story there? Or does fiction and something being fictional have to do with it having a narrative?
Right. Now, so this is an important distinction that I should have mentioned previously, because we often take this term fiction to mean story. And this is the split between it's either real or it's fiction. But from a fictionist perspective, what we call fiction are the things that we are prescribed to imagine. And so I gave the example previously of a nation. A nation is something we are prescribed to imagine. And so the nation has this fictional element to it. And games, even games that don't have an explicit narrative like Super Smash Brothers, are still asking us to imagine various things about their worlds. And the kind of imaginings we have about them have strange and unexpected consequences, like that even though this totally takes place inside a little tiny electronic box, that people all over the world will take an interest in a player who can deliver inside this totally, an artificial is probably the wrong word, but totally artificial world. That's an amazing situation. And yet it's incredibly human. We are always engaging with things around us that at root are things that we're prescribed to imagine.
He was just very, very aggressive, very hyper. It comes to a point where you have to be really defensive against that or be more hyper and aggressive.
And I just felt like I just won the tournament. And I play against Azensmarth. I beat Kensmarth. I got this. I lost.
That is to say, and this is the profound part, there is no meta language which can critique from one level higher our discursive forms for describing reality. Every tension between notion and reality is therefore already in itself an intranotional tension, says Hegel.
And I was right in the middle of that, so I guess his style pretty much countered my style.
I'm so in the zone, and I defeated him.
I could read him. I mean, he was an open book, but it doesn't mean anything if you can read a book if every single time you turn the page you get a paper cut or something like that, you know?
The transcendental object, as purely posited by the subject, appears as an empty abstract surplus which goes beyond the notion. But it is actually just the reification of the notion's tension with itself.
Like, the entire crowd just went uproaring, they were going crazy.
Zizek claims that Hegel was always against intellectual intuition, because to hold that thought is incomplete because external effects are not reality is just to show that our thought is at that level remaining formal abstract. So rather than a deficiency in the intuitive form, i.e. we lack in perceiving reality, and we lack in affect, it's rather a deficiency in the discursive form.
Think about a chess master. and compare him to a Super Smash Brothers player. There's a similar thing going on there, isn't there? I mean, there's this artificial space, or very constructed space, and it's
no, absolutely. It's less representational, because although at one point, obviously, the pieces had a meaning, you know, we now have a piece that's shaped like a castle that can move infinitely in one direction, which no real castle outside of perhaps Japanese anime actually does. So it's not strongly representational, is chess, but yeah, you've still got these complex player practices that require skill to master. And it's fascinating in chess, although I'm not a big fan of chess as a game, its history I find absolutely fascinating, because it goes through phases whereby a new approach to thinking about how to move in the game just upends the apple cart and changes how everyone plays the game. So the way it was played in the early 19th century is completely different to the way that chess players today approach the game. So here we've got a strange, barely representational imaginary world with such complex strategic dimensions to it that it can actually support entirely different player practices according to how different communities of players have approached the game. That sort of situation is what fascinates me as someone who studies games and as someone who makes them.
Something like chess is fictional because the set of rules that we're given prescribe what we should imagine and set up the terms of what we imagine.
Ah, but one of the things I do in imaginary games is point out the rules of these games are also things that we imagine. So, for instance, in the game of chess, the fact that the rook moves in straight lines is something we're prescribed to imagine inside the world of chess. And if you moved it in a different way, you would know you would be doing it wrong, because you would be breaking with that prescription to imagine. Just as if you looked at a painting of Van Gogh's sunflowers and said you were looking at roses, you'd be making a mistake. You'd be making the same kind of mistake if you tried to move a rook in the wrong way in chess.
Right, okay. So, what's fictional is the conceptual nature of the game. The fact that there are rules for how we're going to interpret the world.
Yeah, every time there's a prescription to imagine, there is something we can call fiction there.
Okay, so this is how, at this point, I'm beginning to see a Kantian side to this, maybe, because Kant talks about these categories of perception that are necessary for perception, space and time being two that come to mind, and to him, space and time are fictional, in so much as that there are prescriptions for how to interpret perception that are necessary, but that don't necessarily exist outside of perception.
Yeah, sure. So, and this is what Kant is famous for in philosophy circles to some extent, is to draw out this account of what would be necessary for us to think the world. And it's very compatible with fictionalism, and certainly some of the fictionalists take a Kantian influence. But I think at the same time, Kant is also convinced that there is the opposite side of the subjective coin is this things in themselves that we may not be able to know because we're only forced to imagine them, but they're there and they're fixed in some way that Kant is not quite able to nail down. And one of the interesting things in the way that early 21st century philosophy is going is we're kind of revisiting the split that Kant made here, which I suggested earlier, this split into these boxes of subjective and objective, and saying, well, actually, everything we're putting into objective, we're getting there via the subjective, and everything we're getting to in subjective, we're getting there via the objective. They're all kind of linked up in ways that we've not really taken seriously, and which kind of breaks Kant's system, even though I don't think Kant really got it wrong. It's just we now have a new way of looking at those problems.
Well, you said something earlier that I want to return to now, because, again, this goes to my having read Hegel. Hegel comes along after Kant and says something very close to what you're saying, which is that even this notion of things in themselves outside of perception is a concept, is fictional, because it's a concept that is necessary for us to have, just like space and time, just to have perception. So the objective is a necessary fictional concept, you know, for us to have even the notion of what is subjective or a notion of a world with of objects. It's another one of these rules or that exist. But it doesn't mean to me that means that those the dualism between the subjective and the objective is fictional, but as real as anything else. I mean, you can't get away if you're perceiving the world from that split between the.
Yeah, but I think one of the interesting I've got two points here. One of the issues with fictionalism is that identifying that there is this fictional element in the different parts of our experience is not to say that that they're not real. In fact, it's to do precisely the opposite. It's to say part of how they are real is the fact that we imagine them in these ways. And then that becomes an interesting line of inquiry, because if we want to change the world, if we want to make the world a better place, we need to be able to understand just how much of what is our world is imagined and therefore potentially open to change if we can just negotiate it. But I also, having mentioned Hegel, I have to bring in the old philosopher's adage about Hegel, which is you can't really take him on because he goes everywhere. Hegel makes a point of just covering the whole terrain. So as philosophers like to say, wherever you go, Hegel will be there smiling at you when you get there. There's this sense that he covers the whole landscape of the places to go. And I think that is a fair assessment. But on the other hand, from where he is writing, he can't see all of the corners that we can get into. He may be there before us, but we can see things that were invisible to him when we get there.
What's one of the things that you greats of philosophy can see more than the master Hegel?
Well, here I have to invoke the old standing on the shoulders of giants, because
I knew that would get you if I said it that way.
I never put myself the same level as as some of these philosophers who really set up the condition for the contemporary world in a bizarre way. I feel like I get to play with their ideas, which is fun, but there's no way anyone today can have the kind of influence that Kant or Hegel or even Kierkegaard, Marx and Nietzsche in the 19th century. These figures were uniquely positioned to have an influence that cascades and goes onwards. And now the sheer volume of content out there, books, the internet, TV, there is now so much media, I think it's now impossible for someone to have the influence that some of these voices did when there were fewer books being published and therefore there was a sort of a canonical set of books that you read to get your view of the world. We've moved into a state of chaos, and I think how we negotiate that state of chaos is something that fascinates me.
So just like the Beatles, there'll never be as big a philosopher as Hegel again. There'll never be a band as big as the Beatles again.
Because the circumstances that allowed that to happen no longer exist.
Okay, but you're ducking my real question, which was what do you see or what kinds of things that you think that what corners does fictionalism see that a more traditional Hegelian perspective wouldn't?
Well, I think Hegel does travel the entire landscape of philosophy, and so there are still some sort of hints of the fictionist perspective there. But what the fictionists do is take on specific situations and illuminate them, and Hegel actually spent very little time getting into specifics because he's so very general.
Right.
So Stephen Yablo, for instance, looks at what numbers mean as representations. So there was a long-standing question in philosophy as to whether or not numbers as an abstract entity were real in some sense, which Plato's philosophy sort of hints at. And Yablo comes at this and says, no, they're fictional representations of cardinality, of quantity, if you see what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got here a way of looking at numbers that resolves the question to some extent of whether or not they're real. It's not so much that they're real, it's that they're fictional in a particular way that also happens to be incredibly tightly connected logically. So we can make all kinds of statements about numbers that we just can't make about other kinds of fiction.
Is there an end
to history. Whereas most generally think of history as a record of past events, philosopher Georg Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel considered it to be a rational process, moving towards completion. Make no mistake, by end of history, Hegel wasn't prophesizing the end of the world. But to discover what he did mean, we must first ask ourselves, what is history? According to Hegel, history is the progression of reason brought about largely by confrontation and conflict. For example, if a group of rebels siege a castle, we have two opposing forces, the establishment and the challenger. Through this conflict, the opposing ideologies will collide and produce a new establishment. Like the one before it, this idea will eventually invite upheaval, and the dialectical process, yielding heightened rationality, will continue.
Okay, so to bring this back to video games, but not to Super Smash, don't worry. We generally approach video games, first of all, we trivialize them.
Yes.
And secondly, we don't know how to criticize them. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of, I mean, Gamergate is probably the most extreme example of the kind of split that there is in the gaming community. But there are lots of issues in that other than the games. And you know, I don't want to go into that. But one of the things that's kind of off to the side of that is trying to decide what kinds of values are most important when it comes to video games. Is it the complexity of the engine, or is it the bit rate? Or, you know, what's the most important thing about a video game? And you, I think, have this perspective that maybe the kinds of oppositions that there are between people who want to see games as art and don't care so much about how great a sport a game is, but are more interested in the way that they might be interested in a movie, and those who are more sports oriented when it comes to video games, you see this opposition as not being as significant as people think.
Well, it's tricky because, yeah, on the one hand, the way these oppositions are stacked up against each other as being vital to resolve, I do see that as not that important. But the fact that we have these strong aesthetic positions on games, that in fact every definition of game brings out an aesthetic value judgment about what a game is or what's valuable about a game. And so even though I don't anymore, I've kind of disavowed game as a category, doing that has allowed me to look at how other people use the term game and begin to see the aesthetic values that we're applying. And it opens up this whole landscape of play. And it is fascinating because it crashes into art on one side and it crashes into sport on another. And it has deep parallels with literature in other places. It's an amazingly eclectic landscape. And the fact that we haven't resolved a definition of game is partly because we have so many different aesthetic values for games that we're all pulling in different directions. And that's amazing and so human and so brilliantly human that we do that. I think it shows, for me at least, the real value of games, that we don't agree about them, because if we agreed about them, it would become trivial. The things that bring great value into people's lives are seldom those that are easy to agree on.
Have you played Cookie Clicker?
Cookie Clicker. I know of Ian Bogle's Cow Clicker, which was made as a pastiche of games that primarily encourage you to just do repetitive actions. Right. I imagine Cookie Clicker is in a very similar space.
Cookie Clicker, so I want to ask you, does this constitute a game? Because what happens, my son showed me this, the same one who likes Super Smash, is you get this giant cookie, and you're encouraged to click on it. And when you click on it, your number of cookies goes up. So the first time you click on it, you have one cookie. You click on it again, you have two. And then as you click on it, your cookies allow you to buy things to help you click on the cookie.
Yeah.
And soon enough, you're not clicking on the cookie anymore. You've got all these things that are clicking on the cookie, and you're just managing your cookie count.
Yeah.
And when I first did this, I clicked on the cookie, and I said, Ben, this doesn't constitute a game. There's no game here. I clicked on the cookie. So what? And he said, just wait, click again. And needless to say, 3 days later, that game is still running on, it's not now, but for 3 days, that game was still running on one of my screens. I have two screens constantly running. I got into the quadrillions of cookies.
Yeah.
And I realized that it didn't seem like a game so much as some sort of terrible addiction to clicking on cookies. and it reminded me of a Star Trek episode where an alien race invades the Enterprise by giving them this game that they're constantly...
An episode actually called The Game.
That's right. So does that count as a game? Do either of those things count as a game, or is that a trick? What is that?
Okay, so there's a couple of interesting points that you bring up here. And my first would be, the fact that you are reluctant to call it a game shows you have aesthetic values surrounding play that this transgresses, that this goes outside of your comfort zone. In the same way that art critics looking at Duchamp's ready-mades, the urinal in the art gallery, this isn't art. An aesthetic boundary was crossed. And this game that you've encountered crosses some aesthetic boundary for you. It's not aligning with your previous experience of what makes a game. But I come at this, as I say, by disavowing games. So everything is a potential game to me. I look at what my son imagines, and we would call those make-believe games. So I figure almost any of these things can qualify as a game as long as somebody's willing to call it that. For me, the game that pushes in the direction you're talking about with Cookie Cutter is a game called Progress Quest, which is a zero-player game in the style of World of Warcraft where you do nothing but run it. You run the game, and then it goes off and beats up monsters for you, and you level up and gain ever more ridiculously titled equipment. I played it for a month, and I did nothing. My involvement in this game was only running it and looking at it. And yet, I'm still playing the game because I'm still imagining what's happening in the game world. I'm imagining that these words that are appearing on the screen do reflect some hero going out and killing monsters rather than just some programmer's sick joke about how repetitive something like World of Warcraft is. I'm happy to apply the word game in much more broadly than most other people, but I think doing that gives me a really interesting perspective on what games can be and what they do. And I think that's one of the things that Imaginary Games offers. If you want to start getting a new way of looking at games, Imaginary Games will get you there.
Well, that's great. I think, you know what, we've been talking for about 40 minutes. I think we've got a really good conversation here that I'll be able to edit. But is there anything I didn't ask you that you want to talk about that we didn't cover?
Ooh, what an awful question.
I know, I do that because it's an awful question on two levels. One, it lets me completely off the hook, right?
Yeah.
It's like, I don't have to think. And no, then two, it makes you think.
That's an evil move, Doug. That's an evil move. You've hit the ball right back into my court, and I either have to slam it out the course or surrender to you. So I think you have made a winning move there that I can't actually adequately respond from. Sadly, I have to throw in the towel and declare you the superior player in this particular game.
Well, good game.